wonderful, wonderful station. Just take a lively companion wherever you go. Take a portable radio. Take a portable radio.
Hi there, it's the Radio Stuff Show, episode 77. I'm Larry Gifford, radio consultant and talent coach at LarryGifford.com. Coming up in this episode...
We could be witnessing the end of the internet as we know it.
And I am fearful, somewhat in the radio industry, that we've built a lot of plans on an assumption about IP that I don't think is sustainable.
I'll be the first one to come around. You can bring me back onto your podcast, Larry. And if we come to the point where there is rampant discrimination in the marketplace...
This podcast won't exist if that happens.
As a former CEO of the Academy, I think it's best if I keep most of my thoughts to myself.
What you are about to hear is a direct result of your ideas.
This is a weekly show about radio for radio. You can find all 77 episodes at RadioStuffPodcast.com. We're on TuneIn and iTunes and Stitcher and SoundCloud. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at The Radio Stuff. Our top story.
The Federal Communications Commission has agreed to move forward on a proposal that could change the way we use the internet. At risk, the basic principle of net neutrality.
Net neutrality.
Net neutrality.
The FCC is endorsing new rules that could clear the way for a two-tier system.
The rules would open the door for the first time for internet providers like Comcast and Verizon to charge tech companies to send content to consumers more quickly. Netflix, for example, might pay a premium to ensure that its customers can stream movies more reliably at a cost a startup competitor might not be able to afford.
We could be witnessing the end of the internet as we know it.
Oh, net neutrality. Oh, net neutrality. That's all I hear, net neutrality this and net neutrality that. It will be the word of the year, net neutrality. A lot of people have been poking me on social media saying, hey, are you following this? Are you looking at this? And so I started to. I said, you know, I was kind of ignoring it because I didn't quite understand it. You know, the network's fine for me, and I'm neutral on that. I've been ignoring the issue, like apparently everybody else in radio, for long enough. So this week, I'm going to dive headfirst into it. Now, my goal for this episode is to try to help define net neutrality and, more importantly, what the implications to radio can be depending on what action is or is not taken. I'm not here to push an agenda. I don't even know how I really feel about this at this point. I'm so confused and conflicted, like most people. So I'm just trying to figure out what's going on. My week began with a little help from President Obama.
Ever since the internet was created, it's been organized around basic principles of openness, fairness, and freedom. There are no gatekeepers deciding which sites you get to access. There are no toll roads on the information superhighway. This set of principles, the idea of net neutrality, has unleashed the power of the internet and given innovators the chance to thrive. Abandoning these principles would threaten to end the internet as we know it.
And the president is far from the first person to speak out about it. The most viral statements about this issue came in a summertime rant from John Oliver on his new HBO show Last Week Tonight.
Net neutrality is actually hugely important. Essentially, it means that all data has to be treated equally, no matter who creates it. It's why the internet is a weirdly level playing field. And startups can supplant established brands. That's how Facebook supplanted MySpace, which supplanted Friendster, which supplanted actually having any friends. Do you remember physically having friends? It was awful. You couldn't tap people's faces to make them go away. The point is, the internet in its current form is not broken, and the FCC is currently taking steps to fix that.
So this summer, the FCC had endorsed a plan to approve a two-tiered system, allowing internet providers, ISPs or IPs, basically the cable companies, your Comcast, Time Warner, Verizon, Cox, to charge companies a surcharge in order to send content to consumers, to you and me, at our houses more quickly.
The cable companies will say, oh, they support net neutrality protections, or they remain committed to the open internet, or just the tip. But let me remind you, they also say that they'll be at your house between 2 and 6 tomorrow afternoon. And does any part of you really expect them to f***ing turn up?
Now, Stephen Colbert's character on the Colbert Report on Comedy Central takes a different approach.
Folks, I am so inspired by this new paradigm of holding content hostage that I've implemented a few innovations of my own here at the Report, such as my new Twofinity phone service, where my employees continue to enjoy unfettered access to the first two digits of any number they dial. Are you on fire? Then just dial 9-1. Need another one? Reasonable charges apply.
So this week, the message from President Obama was urging the FCC to endorse a totally different idea.
I'm urging the Federal Communications Commission to do everything they can to protect net neutrality for everyone. They should make it clear that whether you use a computer, phone, or tablet, internet providers have a legal obligation not to block or limit your access to a website. Cable companies can't decide which online stores you can shop at or which streaming services you can use. And they can't let any company pay for priority over its competitors. To put these protections in place, I'm asking the FCC to reclassify internet service under Title II of a law known as the Telecommunications Act. In plain English, I'm asking them to recognize that for most Americans, the internet has become an essential part of everyday communication and everyday life.
Now, in researching and reading and watching videos about net neutrality, aside from the massive migraine I got and nodding off a time or two, I realized all sides of this issue have co-opted the term net neutrality for themselves. Everyone, lawmakers, cable companies, content creators, everyone trying to rally around that phrase, basically removing any real meaning of it altogether. Although I think at the heart of it, I think everybody's intention is the same, but they have different ways of going about it. Among my discoveries through my exploration of net neutrality was this piece from Edward Snowden at TED 2014, where he appeared via video robot. You remember in 2013, Snowden leaked thousands of classified American National Security Agency documents, sparking a global conversation about citizen rights to privacy on the internet. And he talked about the idea of creating rules around net neutrality.
I grew up not just thinking about the internet, but I grew up in the internet. And although I never expected to have the chance to defend it in such a direct and practical manner, and to sort of embody it in this unusual, almost avatar manner, I think there's something poetic about the fact that one of the sons of the internet has actually become close to the internet as a result of their political expression. And I believe that a Magna Carta for the internet is exactly what we need. We need to encode our values, not just in writing, but in the structure of the internet. And it's something that I hope, I invite everyone in the audience, not just here in Vancouver, but around the world, to join and participate.
So this is one of the places where it gets weird. A guy, Snowden, characterized as one of the biggest traitors in U.S. history, not by me, but by others, is calling for, essentially, net neutrality regulation, or as he calls it, a Magna Carta. Just like President Obama, the president of the country he's accused of betraying. Now, they may not agree on how to go about creating the code or the ideology and how to enforce it, but they kind of agree on they want net neutrality. They want to protect it. The other wild part of this is that it's one issue, net neutrality, in the American landscape that really does not divide among party lines. There are people for and against net neutrality on both sides of the aisle. Now, I promise to keep this as apolitical as possible. Sometimes it's hard because that's who's talking about it right now. I mean, you're not going to find a lot of radio people gabbing about this. So the radio executives aren't chattering about this online. People are kind of staying out of it as much as they can. So let's try to go back to the information. Let's figure out what's going on and what it means to radio as best we can figure out. So I now invite to the program Nick Pigott. Nick is a digital radio industry leader and evangelist. He's the head of creative technology for Global Radio in the UK. It's the largest commercial radio group in the United Kingdom. Nick, welcome to the Radio Stuff podcast.
Hey, Larry. Great to be here. Thanks for the invite to talk.
Oh, sure. Now, you're here because I'm not smart. So I need you to help us understand net neutrality. How do you define net neutrality?
Well, net neutrality has acquired quite a lot of different meanings and quite a lot of different understandings in its journey around people's minds. And I think a lot of them are about some concerns and some emotions that the internet is not going to be free anymore. Really, when you boil it down, effect for the average user, what net neutrality means is some things, some particularly media applications that you use are going to work better than others. And that's because the guys who build the IP networks, the Verizons, the AT&T, are trying to work out who should be paying for those networks. Running out IP networks is expensive, and there is a limit to what consumers are prepared to pay for their internet connection at home. And a lot of these guys are saying, well, hey, look, Netflix has made a big business out of riding over the top of our network. They should be paying their share of the cost of building that network. And that kind of comes back to the world of radio, because if you were an IP network operator, you'd say to a radio station, hey, look, you guys are paying for towers and you're paying for power and you're paying for circuits from your studio to the transmitter. You pay now for your primary distribution platform, which is FM radio or HD radio. And those guys, Sirius XM, they're paying for their satellites up in the sky. So we think it's only fair that if you want your radio station to be reliably delivered over our IP network, you should pay for a share of that network cost.
Wow. So why is this suddenly a big issue, sort of a hot topic?
I think it's a hot issue because it has started to hit consumers. And I think it started to hit consumers not because the IP network operators want it to, but because companies like Netflix, as a good example, or Spotify or Pandora, are beginning to get a little bit worried that they are going to get asked to put their hands in their pockets to pay for these networks. And they want to kick up a bit of noise with their consumers, with their subscribers, to say, you shouldn't have to do this. Because the ultimate impact could be that as a consumer, my $10 a month Netflix subscription will jump to $15 a month, and $5 of that is actually going to pay for the distribution costs, which arguably Netflix aren't paying for at the moment. They only pay for their servers. They are not paying for the cables and the wires and the routers and all the hardware that goes into building the physical internet. And those costs are not going down. They are not going down, and they're not going to go down. The rate at which we as consumers are consuming data is going up exponentially. And the rate at which application providers and service providers want to push data over the network is going up similarly exponentially. And the guys who are getting squeezed in the middle are the network operators. And sometimes it's really quite interesting things that illustrate the problem. So if you think about the screen size on the iPhone 4, and then you compare that with the screen size on the iPhone 6 Plus, the iPhone 6 Plus has a stupendously much better screen than the iPhone 4, which means if you're an application developer and you want to put a really good looking picture on that screen, you have to send a much higher resolution picture, which uses much more data capacity to make it look good on an iPhone 6 Plus than you do on an iPhone 4. As a consumer, particularly if you're on an unlimited data plan, you don't care. And as an application developer, the thing you care about is that your application looks good. Mm-hmm. But the guy in the middle is Verizon or Sprint or AT&T, who've got to double or triple their network capacity for no extra money, just so that application keeps working. And the problem is they tend to get the blame. It's the network guys who get the blame when your Netflix is buffering, when iTunes is slow to download, when your Spotify keeps buffering. They get the blame, not the application providers.
So earlier in the podcast, we heard President Obama earlier this week talking about how he's asking the FCC to approve the internet as a utility, essentially, and create these rules of net neutrality, or these, it's not really legislation, but it's sort of regulation. Is that the answer?
I think it's difficult to say. I think probably President Obama's got a better handle on it than Senator Ted Cruz, to be honest. He's probably understood the issue a little bit better. It is a really complicated question, and particularly for radio broadcasters, you shouldn't assume that you're not going to be caught up in this and that you're not going to have an opinion on this. I think there is often, I know that there is often an assumption that because radio uses a relatively small amount of capacity in the network, that we may well slip under the wire. And in fact, a lot of what we've done to date has involved slipping under the wire. We just haven't been seen because our data is relatively small compared to YouTube or Netflix or Spotify. But the issue with net neutrality is it is a policy, it is an ideology, not a technical construct. So the fact that you use a small amount of data or a big amount of data is actually irrelevant about whether or not you should have a view on net neutrality. Net neutrality is about whether or not you can pay a network provider to reliably deliver your content to the consumer. And what is often left unsaid is the flip side to that, which is if you aren't prepared to pay to have your content reliably delivered to the consumer, the chances are it won't get delivered reliably. Because if you are a network operator with a fixed amount of capacity, let's say you've got a gigabit a second pipe, and you've got distribution companies that are prepared to pay, sorry, content companies that are prepared to pay for 90% of that capacity to reliably deliver their video service, their audio, their music over that IP network, everybody else who is not prepared to pay is going to get left in the remaining 10% of the capacity, and the experience will get worse and worse and worse. So there is a real feeling that at the point where a decision is made over net neutrality, the experiences that you will get on the internet will diverge dramatically. For those companies and those services and applications that are prepared to pay, they will work much better. And similarly, those that aren't will work much worse.
So if, let's just say, the U.S. Decides, the FCC says, okay, we're going to create this Magna Carta for the internet or whatever they're going to call it. How does that impact the global community, the World Wide Web? You know, it seems to be a U.S. regulation. How does that go beyond our borders?
Probably technically it won't have too much of an effect, because really what net neutrality is affecting is what's known as the last mile. So it's the connection between your house and the rest of the internet, or your house and the main interconnections with the internet across major population centers in the US. So in terms of the technical implications, the adopting net neutrality in the US wouldn't affect the way that my internet here in the UK works. But I think what it will do is be a bellwether for whether or not net neutrality is a desirable business decision in other countries. And I think a lot of other countries are going to be looking to the US and seeing how this debate plays out, what the decision is and what the implications of that decision are for consumers and for application providers. And it's not a simple thing to say. I mean, at the very top level, you might, if you have a liberal view, you might say the internet should be completely free and it should run the way it runs now. And the difficulty with that is the model that we run on at the moment is not sustainable. Mm-hmm. And there is a real risk that everything will just degrade to a point where nothing works. And even things that you would like to work, your Netflix, for instance, you can't get to work because there is no legally allowed mechanism for you to say, I want Netflix to work. I don't care about the other things, but I want Netflix to work. Because that's the principle in net neutrality, is that you're then picking a specific service and prioritizing it above everybody else. And that could be the unintended consequence, is that we might be able to get away with the current model for a little bit longer, but at some point in the foreseeable future, simply nothing works properly.
So let's play this out a little bit. Let's say the regulation isn't created, and Comcast and Time Warner and Verizon have control of things, and they decide radio is a premium, audio is a premium. What happens to radio's digital footprint?
It's going to be very complicated. And what makes it more complicated is that connections to the home are probably the least contended connections. They're the ones that are under least pressure. Mobile is a very, very significantly expensive and complicated thing to get right. And I think that the risk for the radio industry is that the cost for paying for reliable delivery over a mobile network will begin to look quite expensive on a per listener basis. And that's because it's quite hard in terms of infrastructure, and it's quite hard in terms of spectrum, the amount of capacity these guys are having to use out of spectrum that they've paid the government for and out of masks that they're having to run is not nothing. And the amount of engineering that you have to do to make it work properly like radio is quite considerable. So there's a risk that radio gets into a quite a nasty position where it's not like Spotify and Pandora, who can work with quite unreliable and quite bursty bandwidths by forward caching songs. So if they get a bright spot where there is very little contention, the network is quiet, they can just download a whole load of stuff at super fast speed. And then when the network dries up, it doesn't matter because pretty much all the music that you need is already on your device and you're actually playing from a cache. That doesn't work in radio. If you lose the network for 30 seconds, at some point you're going to lose the audio for 30 seconds because we work in real time. So there's a risk that radio gets hit with a higher cost because it needs the reliability, but is not offsetting that with the kind of $10 a month subscription fee that people are paying for the music services.
All right, Nick, I'm going to appoint you the head of the internet. What do you do?
That is a job that I think in the first instance I would go and find a lot more people to put around me. I honestly, I think it, from an engineering point of view, from a technology point of view, we can't go on as we are. It doesn't work. And probably the hardest thing that the consumers of the internet are going to have to get their heads around is that the internet is not free. And I use, I think, what is quite a useful analogy. And it's a little bit historical, but I think we can always learn something from history. When the first electrical power plants were built, the first generating stations, they were only ever built to put lights on. They were only electrical lighting stations. And they just had enough capacity to keep lights on in houses. And you paid a subscription. You just paid a fixed fee to the electrical generating company. And that gave you electric lights in your house. And because there was an assumption that you had one light per room, you paid a fee, and that was it. But of course, people very, very quickly realized that electricity was far more useful than just lighting lights, and they wanted to use more of it and more of it, and more appliances were designed that could use electricity. But it put such a load on the electrical generating systems, they had to build bigger power plants and huge great power plants, and the investment in infrastructure and thicker wires and more distribution systems put the subscription model under massive pressure, because it no longer seemed fair that you paid a fixed fee for your electricity when some houses were still only using light bulbs and other houses had the heating, the washing, the television, everything else on the electricity. Possibly not the television in those days, but, you know, lots of other appliances. And then we hit a kind of a purple patch where nuclear power came along. And there was an assumption that nuclear power was going to be so cheap to generate that you would still never need to meter anyone's consumption. You could still have as much electricity as you wanted to have, because the cost of generating it would be so low. But that didn't quite work out, because whilst the cost of electricity generation in nuclear is low, all the other associated costs just keep going up. The more electricity you use, you need bigger pylons, you need bigger cables, you've got more nuclear waste to get rid of, you're burning more coal, you're burning more gas. So the only way that you can keep a lid on people's consumption is to bill them based on the amount of electricity they use. And people have broadly got used to the idea that a light bulb is a small amount of electricity, a 32-inch plasma screen is a bit more. Mm-hmm. Having the heating on an electric heating system all summer is a very expensive thing to do. And that might be the journey that we have to take consumers down with IP, that you can't just use all the IP you want all the time for one $40 a month fee.
So how are you feeling, being where you're at, in this moment of the internet? Where do you come down emotionally on this issue?
That is a very good question. Overwhelmingly exciting, but tinged with apprehension, because I don't think we've really thought through past the honeymoon period, and we are beginning to get towards the end of the honeymoon period. And I am fearful, somewhat in the radio industry, that we've built a lot of plans on an assumption about IP that I don't think is sustainable. And we need to probably take this cue that we're getting now from this noise and net neutrality to just think a bit about what would happen if we were having to do bilateral deals with all the major IP carriers to make sure that our services worked, and what would they benchmark the value of that to us, because it will be nothing to do with the physical cost of the network. It'll be a straight business decision of what is the value to you, radio company, of accessing our subscribers and our network. And that will be a new line that will appear on the cost of running a radio station that we haven't thought of.
Nick, I really appreciate your time. My head is about to explode, so I think we have to end this conversation.
Thanks for the time, Tom, Larry.
Now, back stateside, there is opposition, as we mentioned earlier, to the president's proposed net neutrality regulations. And here to help us dive into the anti-net neutrality contingent is a fellow podcaster. He's the host of the show Liberty Radio Ohio and former congressional candidate from Ohio's 12th District. His name is Bill Yarbrough. Bill, welcome to Radio Stuff.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So let's start simple. How do you define net neutrality?
Great question. Because that really frames the entire debate, and you have to have the definition of terms. I think very simply, it's the whole idea that you and I, Larry, as end users, should have the ability to have free access to content that's out there, free from discrimination by internet service providers who would have nefarious intent or specific ideological bents that would prohibit First Amendment free access to information in the marketplace.
And so why are you opposed to that?
See, I'm not. And see, that's the thing. I'm against regulated attempts to reach those ends.
Okay.
There's a big difference there, Larry, because I think there's a boogeyman that's out there associated with this whole idea of net neutrality, and it's a solution looking for a problem, quite frankly. There are certainly isolated incidences, and there are cases that have been brought before the FCC of internet service providers who own that last mile, what they call the last mile, that content to you and me from the hubs or from the CDNs or the transporters of the internet signal, if you will. And they are scare tactics, quite frankly, in order to support one contingent over another. And really, government should not be interposing themselves. You really have these big players. You have the Google and you have the Facebooks on one side, and then you've got the Comcasts and the Verizon and the Cox Cables on the other side. And picking one side versus the other is not the way we should be going about this. And that's what net neutrality legislation really seeks to do.
Well, from a radio perspective, the fear that at least I have is that what if Time Warner, Verizon, Comcast, whoever, determines one day that podcasting or streaming audio is suddenly a premium? What impact would that have on radio innovation?
It certainly could, and I don't think it's going to happen. I think that we could – it's very possible, Larry, to legislate, to regulate against any number of potential dangers that might be out there. It is not in the best interest of any ISP to restrict that access to those services.
What are some of the things that you fear?
Well, I mean, we've seen this happen time and time again. A great radio example, Larry, that you and I were talking about earlier online is with regards to what the FCC did to radio. I think that the death of really, truly unique local radio programming is as a direct result of corruption from the FCC trying to regulate it. Whenever you have government picking winners and losers in the marketplace, it winds up stifling competition. You only have to look to Ma Bell. What happened in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, where if you wanted phone service, you had to go through this monolith. You couldn't even own your own phone. Your phone was owned by the phone company. And it was only until the deregulation of Ma Bell that we saw the proliferation of phone services resulting in cellular service and the like becoming cheaper, more available, the competition that resulted from that. The possibilities of corruption and the stifling of innovation are far greater than any potential solution that is gained through net neutrality legislation.
So I'm going to respond with some comments from former FCC Commissioner Michael Copps.
But I don't want to fall into this trap of this is all about regulation. This is about seeing who is going to be in control of the consumer or the citizen's online experience. Is it going to be, to the maximum extent possible, that citizen and consumer, or is it going to be an ISP, a Comcast, an AT&T, or a Verizon? And that's the way we need to work at that. We should clear all of that underbrush away. This is simply about, is the FCC going to call Advanced Telecommunications, which is logical, which it should do, and treat it as such and have some light-touch public oversight of it. Make the assertion, reestablish the authority, then we can work with Internet service providers and the public interest groups and consumers and fashion the rules.
That is a very lofty goal. And it's, I mean, who could disagree with the whole idea that the end user should be able to be the one that makes the decision on what content they want to see, the speed with which they want to see it. It's a lofty goal. And again, the whole concept of net neutrality, as I think we've defined it commonly here, I mean, who can disagree with it, Larry? It's just whether or not regulation is going to get us to that ends. And he says it's not about regulation, but that's what it's looking to impose to supposedly guarantee that very thing. And with that comes unintended consequences.
Yeah, and I think from a radio perspective, just to bring it full circle, moving forward on a hope and a prayer that they're not going to make audio premium, because, you know, we're struggling with the terrestrial radio band right now. We're looking for alternatives to keep radio alive. Mm-hmm. And the internet seems to be a really viable option for that today. Still right. Expensive. You know, you do the apps and you do this live streaming and you do the podcasts. And, it, you know, that adds up to a nice investment every year. But if that doubles in the course of a year, radio has no option but to shutter their internet operations.
I think there are enough politicians out there who want to make hay out of the issue that if this actually got to the point where nobody could access their iHeartRadio anymore because they can't afford to pay what's charged the Netflixes, and you've got the Comcast that are demanding it, I can guarantee you that you're going to see a Clear Channel that has an incredible amount of muscle on Capitol Hill. There will be legislation, and it will happen. But I also know that that is mutually assured destruction that we're talking about. It's not going to happen. I think there's enough discipline in the marketplace because people do not want to be put in that light. Comcast does not want to be put in the light, and the mere investigation from the FCC causes them to back down in an instant. That's a good thing. That tells me the free market is working and that media shaming works. but by all means, I'll be the first one to come around. You can bring me back onto your podcast, Larry. And if we come to the point where there is rampant discrimination in the marketplace, where these small players can't afford to actually deliver content and people are being cheated of the content as a result, I may change my tune.
This podcast won't exist if that happens.
That's true. I'll give you my phone number off the air. Let's talk about it. I just think preemptive legislation has so many unintended consequences, and we've seen it so many times throughout the course of our history, that it's better to tread lightly in this place until there's actual harm shown. And I venture to say we won't see it.
Bill, I really appreciate your insights and having a conversation about this that didn't get extreme or outrageous or wild, and you didn't hit me, so I appreciate that.
That never happens.
How can people follow you, Bill?
I am currently hosting a web radio program. We deal with national issues, but we really focus on them from a state of Ohio perspective, my home state, and where you indicated I've run for congressional office. That's Liberty Radio Ohio. You can follow us at libertyradioohio.com.
All right. Well, Bill Yarbrough, thanks so much.
Hey, thank you so much, Larry.
Quickly, I think it's important to note that net neutrality isn't just happening here in the U.S. The debate over net neutrality is something that is affecting people all over the globe. Just last weekend in Hungary, these are people protesting in Budapest. They've actually collected obsolete computing equipment that's just been lying around, and they started to hurl it at government buildings. This came after the prime minister submitted his 2015 tax plan to parliament, including a new tax that will charge 62 cents U.S. dollars for every gigabyte of data transferred over the internet. Now, the government said it'll cap it at $2.88 a month, and service providers, not individuals, would be responsible for paying it. But everybody knows you tax the service providers, they're going to send that on to the consumer, and taxes go up over time. This is a crazy scene. Check out the video online. So what do we learn today? You know, this, I know, it's numbing, isn't it? From a radio perspective, here are my takeaways. And these are in no particular order. No one in U.S. radio is really talking about this. And I think they should be. Now, I do believe our radio industry leaders are a little bit like a child going through a divorce. They're being quiet and nice to both sides because they're not sure who's in the right. And they're not sure who they're going to have to live with long term. So they're like, I'm not going to speak out against the cable companies. I'm not going to speak out against the FCC. Everybody's just sort of leaning back, waiting to see what happens. And then they're going to make their move at that point. But I really think radio needs to speak up here. I mean, the fact or the fear, it's not a fact, it's a fear, that the cable companies, if in charge, could, you know, say, hey, well, you know how much you're paying for your tower over there? We'd like to charge you about the same amount of money to use our ISP. That is a problem. IP costs are going to rise. They're going to rise. Will they rise to the levels of the AM/FM transmitters? I don't know. But if that's the case, if that happens, radio's got some serious soul searching to do. What's next? And then the other thing here is trust is a hard game to play, right? It's hard to trust people, especially people you don't know, especially people you can't look in the eye and shake their hands with. This whole issue comes down to trusting one side over the other. Do you trust the cable companies to self-regulate and keep the internet free and open and to treat radio right? Do you trust the government with their light touch regulation and not to overreach? Do you distrust one more than the other? We already deal with the FCC on so many issues in radio. Is it a big deal to deal with them with something else? Or is that just too much oversight at that point? I mean, it's confusing. Cox Communications is an ISP and a radio company. Do their radio stations then end up getting preferential treatment? I mean, there's a lot of issues here. So hopefully we've added some clarity to the conversation and giving you some insights into how this could affect radio. But again, everything's an if, a maybe, a could, a should, a would. Nothing's concrete because there's so many plans and ideas in the air. And again, everybody's co-opting net neutrality as their own. So at the end of the day, when you begin to research this, you'll see all sides claiming to want net neutrality. And I think that's a problem for us, the consumers, because we don't know who to believe.
Ending net neutrality would allow big companies to buy their way into the fast lane, leaving everyone else in the slow lane. Although telecom companies would prefer that you put it in a slightly different way.
When you say fast lane and slow lane, it's a good illustration. But what you really should be talking about is a fast lane for everybody and a hyperspeed lane for others.
Bullshit.
Everybody's voting for the friendly voice of radio, the people's choice. East Coast, West Coast, in between, it's radio that makes us see.
If you live in the UK, last Friday, it was like the Radio Academy broke Twitter. They canceled their annual radio festival. They canceled the former Sony Radio Awards, and they started firing people or eliminating staffers. One of the reasons this comes as a shock is that it was just September 27th, less than 2 months ago, less than 100 days into her tenure as the chief executive of Radio Academy, that Gloria Abramoff told Radio Today podcast of her grand plans.
So I want the festival to be the best festival where you can learn and meet and negotiate and commission and pitch I want the Academy Awards to be the best awards. I want the Hall of Fame to be brilliant.
Everything you love about what we do, yeah, we're not going to do that anymore. So what it said is, following a strategic review, the Radio Academy Awards will not be held in May next year. The BBC, Global, Bauer, UTV, RIG, and Radio Center all are aligned in their ambition to create a new event, most likely in London, designed to celebrate and reflect the radio industry in a dynamic and modern way. Cheaper. I'm guessing that's what it means. Former Radio Academy head Trevor Dan opened his Radio Today podcast this week with his thoughts.
But first, a quick word, if you'll forgive me, about this week's biggest radio story, the announcement by the Radio Academy that we've seen the last of the former Sony Radio Awards and the last radio festival, at least in their current forms. The Academy's HQ staff, Mandy, Nella, Caroline and Risa, are all being made redundant. And although there's a promise from the current chairman, Ben Cooper, that a new event will be developed, details are sketchy to say the least. Now, as a former CEO of the Academy, I think it's best if I keep most of my thoughts to myself, except to wish the staff well and recommend them to any potential employers who might be listening to this. What I will say, though, is that the press release did send out a rather negative message about our industry, which seemed only a few weeks ago in Salford to have rediscovered some of its old confidence, and I think that's a shame. Also, last time I checked, the Radio Academy is a member organisation, so I hope the industry cheeses who've made this announcement hold some elections and get some new trustees on board who represent the broad range of radio. Presenters, producers, lecturers, yes, even podcasters, not just managers.
You can listen to Trevor Dan's podcast on the Radio Today. Just Google Radio Today and podcast. Hopefully somebody picks up the baton and runs with the festival and awards concept in the UK. It seems like a worthy tradition to keep alive. I know a lot of people were on Twitter sort of bemoaning the fact that the awards are going away. Like, it used to be a really huge honor to be nominated for a Sony. Then Sony got out of the picture, and now the award doesn't exist at all. But alas, things come and go. And that was the case in Canada this week, too. Bob FM in Ottawa, with its 80s, 90s, and whatever format, suddenly silenced, everybody abruptly fired, described in one trade as decimation of the staff. On the Bob FM website, it reads, "Thank you. The last 11 years have been a blast, and we hope you've enjoyed it as much as we have. Market conditions have changed, and it's time for us to pursue a new opportunity." Which I love. The radio station's pursuing a new opportunity. And then at noon on November 12th, this happened.
May we have your attention, please? This is CKKL Ottawa, a division of Bell Media. What you're about to witness is the birth of a brand new radio station. A station that has been designed exclusively for Ottawa. During the last 6 months, 93.9 has been talking and listening to thousands of radio listeners in Ottawa. What you are about to hear is a direct result of your ideas. You told us you wanted a radio station that plays songs you didn't hear much of anywhere else. Music that is upbeat and fun. Country girl, shake it for me, girl. Shake it for me, girl. Music that makes you feel alive. And music that's relatable, just like real life. You demanded a radio station that listens to you. That plays lots of music without lots of commercials. Stand by.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Ottawa's new Country 94. Kicking off 10,000 songs in a row, non-stop.
Baby, you're a song, you made me wanna roll my window.
Educates, syncopates, radio communicates, radio, the sound of year-round pleasure.
Breaking news. Radio is dead. Yeah. I read it on the internet, so it must be true. It's the message this week from marketing guru Seth Godin. Now, Seth has been down on radio for a while. And how do I know that? Well, because he told me directly. June 26, 2011, I attended a Seth Godin event in Seattle, and I asked him, what's the future of radio? And his response was, quote, terrestrial radio is D-E-A-D dead. He went on to explain that radio was built on a model of scarcity. If you owned a radio station, you were one of, say, 14 stations in a city. The number of commercials were finite, as were the number of places you could play commercials. In 3 years, he said, when Wi-Fi is readily available in everyone's car, those 14 stations become 14 million stations, including channels you can program yourself, and thus scarcity is gone forever. Your options are infinite. That same year, he appeared on a video blog with Mark Ramsey of Mark Ramsey Media while promoting his new book, Poke the Box.
Yeah. Well, so let's talk about broadcast for a little bit. Clearly, anyone who has looked at pop music knows that novelty is as important as ever, if not more important, that radios are merchants of musical novelty, that classical music stations tend not to do very well. And one reason is because there's not a lot of new classical music to listen to. So part of the reason we listen to music is to hear something new. And yet, radio stations seem stuck when it comes to ideas of format, connection to listeners, creating social movements, creating all these other forms of novelty. And so the internet says, all right, we'll do that instead. You don't have to do it. We'll take care. And they're leaving attention on the floor. They're leaving behind all of these ways that they could get people to engage. And what is the best people in radio are doing is saying, you know what? I'll just start my own radio station. That's what the internet is. It's a free radio station for people with the guts to go find listeners. So Leo Laporte, starting not with music, but with nonfiction, Leo Laporte takes home millions of dollars a year personally by running what is basically a radio station on the internet about technology. And it's going to be repeated again and again. If you want to talk to people for a living, if you want to use this connection, you can't rely on the handout of Herbert Hoover of 1928 when they gave frequencies to all these people for nothing, because those frequencies are getting less valuable every single day. And instead, people are focusing their attention in a different place. Sure, the radio might be on, but there's a difference between being on and you having attention. And the simple example is, if you got on the radio and said, please call me right now, how many times would the phone ring? Because I guarantee you, if I went on my blog and said, here is Mark's phone number, please call him, his phone would ring.
So Larry, why are you referring to things Seth said 3 years ago? Well, because he wrote a new blog piece this week, banging the same drum. And here's parts of it. 8 years ago, he said, 8 years, not just three, 8 years ago, I described how a citywide Wi-Fi would destroy the business of local radio. Once you have access to millions of radio stations online, why would you listen to endless commercials and the top 40? I realized, he says, last week that this has just happened, not via Wi-Fi, but via Bluetooth and the smartphone. The car sharing driver, Bluetooth-equipped car with a smartphone, of course, who picked me up the other day, was listening to a local radio station. It was almost as if he was smoking a pipe or driving a buggy. How quaint, thanks. With so many podcasts, free downloads, and Spotify stations to listen to, why? With traffic, weather, and talking maps in your pocket, why wait for the announcer to get around to telling you what you need to know? Well, here's where Seth doesn't really understand the value of a relationship that listeners have with their radio stations, but I digress. The first people to leave the radio audience will be the ones that the advertisers want most, and it will spiral down from there, he says. Just as newspapers fell off a cliff, radio's about to follow. It's going to happen faster than anyone expects. And of course, it will be replaced by a new thing, he says, a long tail of audio that's similar but completely different from what we were looking for from radio all along. And that audience is just waiting for you to create something worth listening to. All right, Seth. By the way, I'm a Seth Godin fan. My picture is on the book cover of one of his books in the inside jacket. I've paid to see him speak. I've bought all of his books. I've read them all. I'm a fan. But Seth, the point is, radio's not dead. radio is evolving, as all things do. You say, it will be replaced by a new thing, a long tail of audio that is similar but completely different. Okay, then that becomes radio. Phones aren't what they've always been, but they're still a phone business. Computers are completely different from when they where they were 15 years ago, but they're still a computer business. I can stop my TV, rewind it, fast forward it, slow it down, record my favorite shows, put picture in picture on a 90-inch plasma flat screen. That's a far cry from the 10-inch black and white I had from childhood with three channels, but there's still a TV business. Would you please stop panicking the people? I think this is what James Cridlin calls a doom monger. Radio is not dead. It's changing. It's evolving. It's merging with new technologies. Hey, some stations are going to die. Others will be born. Listeners will come. Listeners will go. Talent will lament. Budgets will fluctuate. Strategies will morph. That's life, man. Radio is what we make it. I think there's too many people standing on the front lines of radio for it to fade into oblivion. Regardless of whatever happens with net neutrality, regardless of who owns what, radio's adapting and has adapted time and time and time again. Maybe you won't call it radio, Seth. Maybe you'll call it, you know, the long tail of audio, or, you know, I'm just listening to my favorite personalities on podcasts. All right, fine, have it your way. But in the meantime, can you go kick some other industry while they're down and stop throwing dirt on our heads? And that's the radio stuff. Email me at radiostuffpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks to formatchange.com, Bill Yarborough, Radio Today, and Nick Piggott. Be sure to read my blog and watch the Ask Larry video blog at larrygifford.com. And think of me if you're in need of a radio consultant or a talent coach. You can find more radio stuff at radiostuffpodcast.com. Have fun, be creative, support each other, and share your radio stuff.